Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise. Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
So sorry. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Ezra just spit milky iced coffee all over me. So it's really good to have him back in the studio. Hello, welcome to another episode of the Weeds on the Bucks Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, joined today by Ezra Klein, who I guess in the new format, Ezra's now like an expert.
Is that right? Yeah. I'm the interview. I'm not just a panelist today.
I think that's how it works.
Ooh, yeah. That's great.
Technically. I mean, I guess it's our show, so we can do it however we want. Okay. There's a lot of Democratic debate lately. It was, I would say most of the commentary on this has been pretty horse racy. In some ways, deservedly so, because it was like 20 people up
there. It is part of the horse race.
Right. But I mean, also, like, it's just like a big question here in like a huge field of 20 people is like who will be like a real candidate later in the process who we really like dig deep in. But there was like some policy ground staked out. And this is the Weeds.
A lot of policy ground staked out.
And we want to talk about it. And I think, to me, the most striking thing was the very large number of Democrats who agreed with a Julian Castro proposal to repeal Section 1325 of, I guess, the Immigration and Naturalization Act. Because both, like, Beto's refusal to agree to this was, like, everybody agreed, like, a catastrophic moment for his candidacy. And then tons of people signed up for it. And this is, like, a completely unfamiliar policy topic.
And a couple days before the debate, Elizabeth Warren had endorsed it.
Had endorsed it, right.
So but what, like, is it, Matt?
But so, like, 2 weeks ago, I had no idea. But okay. So since ERIRA, which we have talked about many times with Dara on this podcast, in the mid-1990s, the American government for the first time created a specific crime of entering the United States illegally. Right. So previously it had been that, like, it wasn't legal to enter illegally. And that meant various things followed from being present in the country without legal authorization. But there wasn't like a crime of it. But in 1996, this crime was created.
It was against the civil code, though.
Right. I mean, but in the general sense that, like, to open a restaurant, you need to get a permit. Right. And so, like, if you don't have a permit, that's illegal. And, like, they'll shut your restaurant down.
Right.
Right. But what this changed was that in addition to you could be deported because you weren't here illegally, there was also—
You weren't here legally.
Right. There's also now, like, a crime. And they could prosecute you for the crime of illegal entry. This does not happen in practice an enormous amount. Right. Like, the standard deportation process is they deport you. They don't— Like, the American government's goal is not to have unauthorized people in American jails, but it is an option that is available to prosecutors. And in particular, it was when we talk about, like, the family separation policy of the Trump administration, what was happening there on a technical basis is that at the authorized border crossings, they were doing metering, right? So they were saying, like, people can't come at the legal ports of entry and apply for asylum. So then people would cross the border between the points of entry, and try to make asylum claims there. And the Trump administration was saying, no, when you come across between the ports of entry, we are going to prosecute you for the crime of illegal entry. And then because you are being prosecuted for a crime, you go to pretrial detention. And then because you're in pretrial detention, we don't normally send children into jail.
Right.
So you become separated from your parents. And so this has entered the discourse as family separation. And almost everybody agrees that the family separation was horrifying and like the Trump administration backed down from it. So if you were to imagine Democrats standing up there, putting their hands up, being like, do you want to make sure that this family separation never happens again?
Right.
And all the Democrats held their hands up. Everyone would be like, that is an incredibly banal debate moment. I have rarely seen something so banal as Democrats universally rejecting a Trump administration policy that was so hideously unpopular that Trump himself abandoned it within 36 hours.
But
however, reframing it as we are going to decriminalize crossing the border, suddenly it's like a very unfamiliar and like, I don't want to say it's unpopular because it's so outlandish that as far as I know, nobody has ever pulled it. But like it doesn't sound good. And you're going to be up there with Trump has been saying for years that the Democratic position on immigration amounts to open borders. And what Castro proposed and Warren agreed to and then got everybody else to agree to, like it really isn't open
and not
borders?
Everybody, we should say.
Yes.
But a number of candidates on the two stages. And what's something I noticed in the second debate was that there was even less dissension over it than in the first. Like people had watched Beto get his butt handed to him on this and decided not to be in his
position.
That's
what I was struck by. And in particular, like Joe Biden, right?
Yes.
Like the electability candidate who knows that people on the left are going to complain about him no matter what he does. Right? Because like,
yes.
People on the left don't want Joe Biden to be the nominee because Joe Biden is like not a diehard left-winger. I had expected him to like spend 12 hours prepping on this so that unlike Beto,
yes.
He could make a defense of the position. He could say, here's what my Joe Biden mind meld. I was waiting for it to be like, listen, I care about the interests of millions of long settled undocumented people in the United States. Me and Barack, like we fought for comprehensive immigration reform. We fought to prioritize criminals. We fought for DACA. We fought for DAPA. Like this is like hard work, but it's incredibly important, and we've been driving at it for years. And I think it would be incredibly irresponsible to the interests of those people to like completely derail this quest in favor of a like
I'll
unpopular
go a step further
and obscure.
Than this. I thought Bernie Sanders, who has the credibility on the left sometimes to not go where other candidates on the left go, might do the same thing. I mean, I've talked to Sanders about open borders, and he's a borders guy. Bernie Sanders has, during his career, looked at immigration with some skepticism, feels it really cuts the wages of native-born workers,
I mean,
feels
is...
open borders is a Koch brothers plot. So my point is not that it was certain,
yes.
But I thought both Biden and Sanders, for different reasons, both that they're leading in the polls, but also that for different reasons they have the ability to stand up to some of these trends. They're not like a lower tier candidate trying to jump a couple levels in the debate. Might say like no, like we're not actually going.
And
there.
I can also say as a journalist, this is like always like my worst nightmares because like I can imagine writing a billion fact checks and explainers like 12 to 18 months from now about how like okay, but you can still be deported. Right? So like on the one hand, it really isn't open
borders.
It's
not open borders.
And on the other hand, like it's not that helpful to people, right? Like in the very specific context of this family separation thing, like the fact that this law was on the books made a big difference. But family separation was actually one of the rare instances. There are a lot of things where like Trump has found odd legal loopholes laying around, like this Emergency Economic Powers Act and like national security tariffs on European cars and stuff, and exploited the loopholes. And a lot of people have been like, whoa, that goes against the norms. And family separation, like that actually worked. Like keep back
yes.
down.
So let's put a pin in family separation because what and 1325 because I think I want to draw a kind of picture
yeah.
of an underlying dynamic of the debate. So then something that happens both nights is, I should say, the way the debate moderators approach a debate, and this was the first of the Democratic debates, was they did not want people to explain their policies. They were looking for like the seams in the Democratic arguments. Like every single question, more or less, was, hey. We know you support like liberal policies, but do you support the most unpopular part of every one of those policies? Not how does it – like what do you want to do on healthcare or how does Medicare for All work? But raise your hand if you want to abolish private insurance. And so night one, you have importantly Warren raise her hand alongside –
It was Warren and de Blasio.
Warren and de Blasio. And Warren raising her hand was important here because she has been holding – she does not have her own healthcare plan yet.
Right.
And she's been holding to a, I like Bernie's plan. There are a lot of ways to get to Medicare for All. I'm not going to like pin myself only to one. And that's been creating some frustration. Like Jacobin's been hitting her for it. I mean, there's been a sense of her being fuzzy in this place of real important to liberals. But no, she like raises her hand, says healthcare is a basic human right. I fight for basic human rights. I wasn't shocked by this because in my interview with her about a month ago, I had asked her about markets and healthcare and she said, nope, it just doesn't work there. Like healthcare is a basic human right. She's clearly beginning to work on this answer. But she – it felt to me that that week Warren's team looking at their polling had decided there's going to be no room to our left. Like there's going to be no space for Sanders on our left. Like we are going to take the abolished private insurance lane with him. We're going to endorse Julian Castro on 1325. Like there's going to be nowhere you can go
right.
on our left. Like that's not going to be a vulnerability for us. So the second night then this comes up again. And of course, Sanders raises his hand on it and Kamala Harris raises her hand on it. Point is, this ends up becoming a debate about abolishing private insurance, not really about Medicare for All, but about this quite again, unpopular part of this otherwise quite popular policy. But then it gets taken in a couple other directions. There's another one of these raise your hands if questions, which is healthcare for undocumented immigrants,
right.
which this is something Barack Obama very specifically wrote out of the Affordable Care Act. Then there was that whole thing where Joe Wilson yelled during the healthcare speech, you lie. And there's been efforts on this. California has been looking for an Obamacare waiver for a couple of years to try to add undocumented immigrants to their plan. But every Democrat on the stage raises their hand on this. And I want to say for the record, I think this is obviously good policy. I think that – and Buttigieg in particular, by the way, tried to walk a line on it where he says, look, it doesn't – he basically said it doesn't mean they get subsidies, but of course they can buy in. Like undocumented immigrants, one, are human beings. Two, are people who handle our food and care for our children and ride the bus with us. The idea that like disease cares about your citizenship papers is crazy. You don't want to catch anything. Like the whole thing is just like a weird like I want to catch a flu to spite my face policy. But anyway, it's quite unpopular. It's been like a third rail in healthcare for a long time in liberal policy circles and every Democrat endorses it. This is then what Donald Trump tweets about after the debate. And then there's a moment where Bernie Sanders says, and just to be clear, Medicare for All will, of course, pay for abortions, which, again, I think is reasonable and actually good policy. It's what you see in other countries. But overall, what you saw was the Democratic field moving like quite far to the left on a lot of policies. And then the candidates who didn't want to do that, like a Bennett, a Hickenlooper, a Delaney, they get no traction. Biden doesn't want to create space on his left, so he's not picking any of these fights. And so overall, like the whole field shifted in a direction of, I would say, opening a lot of vulnerabilities for the general election.
And so I agree with all that. I would also say just I was surprised. Like a thing that candidates often have done in debates in the past is attack the moderators. And I was surprised that you didn't see that there, right? Because I understand what the moderators are doing, right? Like we are media personalities. I have been known to like try to create entertainment in a discussion of politics, right? And so like essentially what they were doing for 4 hours across two nights was a series of like shit tests for Democrats running for president, right? Like they were not trying to explore the yes. nuances of Medicare for All. They were like very deliberately saying, okay, I am going to take the most unfavorable framings
yep.
of policy issues and I'm going to put you in a difficult position of either embracing an unpopular framing of your own policy or else creating tension between you and Bernie Twitter. It's not like – I don't know. It's the moderator's prerogative to use their time that way if that's what they want. But like it's also the candidate's prerogative to like push back on that,
yep.
right? Like
– which Harris did a little bit not in one of these raise your hand questions, but the first moment where you really saw like her command of the debate was she got the third question.
Right.
And the first two were these same kind of like how will you pay for it? And then it goes to Harris and it's like how will you pay for all these like free calls?
Yes, yeah.
And she says, you know, I didn't hear you all asking that question when Donald Trump was
right.
passing taxes for the top 1%. And it may not literally be true that MSNBC wasn't asking that question
right.
at that time, but it was a very effective rhetorical
But like
move.
You could have said right in the second night, Harris could have said very genuinely, you know, I watched last night's debate. I watched 1 hour of the debate. Then I watched a second hour of the debate. And then I watched 1 hour of this debate. I watched you guys ask no questions about what we are going to do to help millions of Americans who don't have health insurance. I watched you ask no questions about what you are going to do for millions of Americans who want to afford prescription drugs. No questions about what you want to do for senior citizens who struggle with Medicare gaps, right? I would like to tell people what I am going to do about all of that. What I am going to do about all of that is create a Medicare for All plan. The Medicare for All plan is going to have no premiums. It's going to have no deductibles. It's going to have no cost sharing. And like, yes, it is true that because you are going to be able to see any doctor in America with no deductible and no cost sharing, you are not going to buy a secondary private insurance plan. To me, that is common sense. The way you phrased it is obviously designed to make me look bad. I get it, like all's fair in love and war. But like, honestly, I think what's important here is the millions of Americans who are struggling to afford health insurance, right? Like the immigration stuff like is a little different, but like on healthcare, like healthcare is an important topic, right?
Well,
like,
this in general,
people,
one thing about
a lot about it.
Well, one thing to be like media critic for a minute is that I think this made for a debate that was quite hard to follow for people because the moderators were looking for narrow questions that would create this kind of conflict. They were getting into things that were very complicated to follow. There was another one on the first night about would you restore the Iran deal exactly as it had been before, which is just like a weird. Like, that's probably not on the table. You would have a new negotiation. So you had Cory Booker say, well, like, it's a good deal, but, like, of course it'll be a new negotiation.
Like, a much more normal like question would be, like, what do you think about Iran?
Yeah.
Right?
And so there just wasn't a lot of that. And so, you know, most people are not paying that much attention to the campaign. Like, these debates are the first exposure a lot of folks are going to get to the candidates. It's not a problem, I think, to at some point try to like explore the divisions between them. But for the only thing you do to be exploring the divisions between them, I think both is it just makes it a hard to follow debate even aside from everything else because you end up in these very technical parts of the answers. That said, one thing you saw underneath the debate was a real feeling that the only way to win in the Democratic Party right now is to move pretty hard to the left. And something that's interesting about that is that given Biden's like continued position on top of the field, we haven't seen obviously post-debate polling, but he has held it for quite some time. It's not really obvious that's true, right? The whole thing is holding on Bernie Sanders' ground, but whether or not like Bernie Sanders or Barack Obama understood the Democratic Party better is interesting. And Obama, if you go back to 08, much like Clinton and others, like very much had a view that there were limits on what the population would accept from Democrats, right? Obama always was somebody who had a sense that if you go too far, you're going to lose like voters in the middle. And so he would try to not go too far. I mean, he, you know, at least in the campaign, you know, wouldn't support the individual mandate. He did not have a single payer health care plan bill. He was somebody who I think to his discredit at this point, but nevertheless, really pushed for a border security and deportations approach on immigration to build credibility that would then get you a comprehensive deal. Now, some of what you're seeing reflects a sense that that kind of politics has failed. And I think it's an interesting dynamic within at least elite circles in the Democratic Party. But nevertheless, it's created a push that I think is pretty profound to the left. And we don't really know how that will play out. And we also don't know how much the policies that they are taking are going to be held to.
Here's where I want to complain about Joe Biden, right? Because there is clearly – like it is just not true that the Democratic Party is composed at its rank and file level of hard left ideologues, right? And like we see time and again, right? When Andrew Cuomo ran against Cynthia Nixon in New York in a, you know, liberal blue state, like he won handily against her, right? When Dianne Feinstein got a challenge from the left from I'm forgetting his name, the state Senate president,
yeah,
right? But it was important there because her challenger was the president of the California State Senate, like not the star of Sex and the City, right? A totally credible left-wing challenger. And he lost, like, again, pretty badly in a blue state, right? You have insurgent wins, right? AOC won in Queens. This woman won. Caban won this Queens DA race.
Ianna Pressley in Massachusetts.
Yeah, Ianna Pressley. So, you know, left wins in certain places, but it's very common for more.
Like Abdul al-Sayed did not win in Michigan,
exactly.
Like even the Democratic primary.
Exactly. So it's very common for more moderate Democrats to win a primary, right? Biden is in a weird meso position as a candidate, which is as former vice president of the United States, he is such a strong contender that he sucks up the support of a very large number of people who would be inclined to support a more moderate Democrat. But at the same time, he's like 117 years old. He is embroiled in like – not like an unwillingness to provide free abortions for illegal immigrants, but like controversies about working with segregationists in the 1970s. And he's not as strong, I think, potentially a face for that kind of politics as some of the other people in the field. But it's really, really hard, right? Like the candidates who are more left-wing than Biden can like take him on. But it's very challenging for Amy Klobuchar to just like make the argument that like you should just have me stand up for these positions, but like be a younger person with a more modern sensibility about the world and like less weird nostalgia for the 70s. And it would be healthier, I think, to have that, because there's a bunch of people like not unreasonable candidates like Hickenlooper, Klobuchar, Michael Bennett.
But I think this is literally what Buttigieg is doing. Yeah. I think an interesting thing about Buttigieg is he really doesn't get into this competition.
Tries.
So he doesn't do the Medicare for All, abolish private insurance.
Right.
Like his view is like, I am a younger person
who's
like more inspiring, who is sort of a mainstream Obama-style Democrat, and you should vote for me. And I was actually struck by the degree to which he didn't try to sort of move to anybody's left on policy. I thought he did a nice job in the debates, and but I think he's like coming in a slightly weak position now given the shooting in South Bend. But I was really struck by, I think of everybody, he is in a way making the most direct play for Biden's lane.
Yeah.
By sort of like running an Obama 08 candidacy himself. I don't think he is not Obama. I think you'd have a lot of trouble putting together that coalition. But I do think it's notable that when these things come up, even in the healthcare for undocumented immigrants, the question went to him and he walked it back, right? He said, yeah, but it's not like they're going to like get covered through subsidies. They could just buy in.
But here's what's interesting, because so I've sat down with some people to talk about how they in polling terms are seeing what's going on here. And demographically, right, conceptually, it feels like Warren and Sanders are playing in the same place and that maybe Buttigieg and Biden are. But in terms of voting base, it's like Warren and Buttigieg have the same voters, right? There's incredible fluidity between Warren supporters and Buttigieg supporters. And I was told in particular that like Buttigieg supporters are the most keyed in people. So there was incredible overrepresentation of Buttigieg fans in the audience for the first debate, right? Like which he wasn't in. And they were super impressed with Elizabeth Warren.
Huh.
Right? Because like he wasn't there, right? And there's also like people don't, I think, know this, but there's like incredibly dense like interpersonal network ties between Warren and Buttigieg.
Yes, which has created incredibly dense interpersonal staff enmity.
Yes, I mean, and it's problematic in a way. But so like sociologically, like Warrenism and Buttigiegism are very, very similar.
Yes.
And by the same token, Sanders and Biden both have much more of a working class constituency. And at this point, Bernie over-indexes on African-American support, which is different from how it was in 2016. I mean, his overall support is lower, right? But what Bernie has mostly lost since 2016 is white voters, and he has made some gains with African-Americans as he's become like a better known, more seen as like a Democratic Party type presence. So it's a bit of a curious thing. Like I think we all know that like voters don't really vote on policy, but like the candidates really are talking like a lot about policy, mm-hmm. seemingly in the hopes of winning votes. That in itself like it's its own strange dynamic, because I'm not really sure what anyone is accomplishing out there. And it's striking to me too, like how many issues have gone off the stage in a kind of odd way. Like almost nobody like talked about how like Donald Trump is a bad president or
– but wait, let's take a break and then come back and talk about this in a slightly more like rigorous way.
Okay.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot-button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
I think we should just go through some of the candidates on their own and just talk about sort of what they did in the debate, probably some of the top tier ones. And I want to start here with Kamala Harris, who is far and away, I think, the breakout star from the debates.
Yeah.
I think that it's important to get the backdrop of Harris. I don't think I've ever seen a politician trajectory quite like hers in the sense that the Democratic Party has a lot of internal schism. It has Bernie voters who don't like sort of the Democratic establishment. It has Hillary Clinton voters who don't like Bernie Sanders. It has Obama administration people who don't like Elizabeth Warren. It has, you know, folks from a younger and more diverse party who don't want to be represented by an old white man. It's got all of these things inside a quite diverse coalition that make it somewhat hard to hold together. And the thing about Harris has been she's quite new on the national scene. And it's like if you had created a candidate in a lab who maybe could hold this together, she's the sort of candidate you would create. But candidates who look good on paper often don't perform well under the lights. And so there's been this burbling question. There are a lot of parts of the party that want to embrace Harris. But there's been this, like, can she do it question around her, right? Mm-hmm. There's nobody seen that much of her. She does a nice job in, you know, Senate hearings, but she's only been in so many of them, having only been in the Senate for a couple of years. But she didn't have, like, the Obama 2004 DNC speech, right? Nobody quite knows how she can perform. And in this debate, like, she just walked in and owned it.
Yeah,
and
she's a killer.
And she in particular did something I think really sharp, which is she walked in and she took apart Joe Biden. Now, usually people don't go, particularly in those upper tiers of the campaign, they don't really go negative quite this early because, you know, why risk it? But what she kind of did was she took on Joe Biden in a way that was the real message of it, I thought, was if I can do this to him, look what I could do to Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Like, can't you imagine me in the debate with Donald Trump, taking apart that old white guy too.
Yeah.
And what she – like, it was a very, very effective attack on Biden, sort of using busing and using her own personal experience. It both sort of like offered a sort of note about who she is and what she has come through and what she can speak to. And also it exposed a lot of weakness on Joe Biden's part, not just weakness in terms of he's got old positions to answer for, but weakness in that he's not prepared to answer for them. Right. What she also exposed was just a preparatory and performative weakness on Biden's part. We'll see if it matters in the polls. Oftentimes these things don't matter as much as you think they will. But in terms of sort of like elite, like how is Joe Biden going to perform? Yep. Is his age going to show? Like, you know, is he going to be able to kind of knock this stuff back? He took a lot of questions that were there and opened them quite a bit further. And so what you have right now is, I think, a lot of candidates who clearly could represent a faction of the party. But Harris has always been like the part – like the candidate you would imagine being a party decides candidate, the candidate that a lot of different groups could agree on. If only she could show them that she could bear that weight. And she began showing that she could bear that weight, I think.
I agree with all that. I just – to issue a note of dissent in a day where I think most of the coverage is like extremely pro-Kamala, I think a lot of the electability worries that have been in the neighborhood of Elizabeth Warren like really should apply to Kamala Harris, right? Like when you were talking about like Harris as a Democratic coalitional candidate, like that's all correct. And I think almost like catastrophically so, that it's like you need to imagine a person who is not strongly identified with the Democratic Party. Who are they going to want to vote for in a general election?
Well, do you or do you need to imagine? I mean, going back, there's a theory that you have to win the white working class. But also, if Hillary Clinton had had Obama's turnout among African Americans, he would have won.
Yes. And if
– or she would have won. I'm sorry.
That would be a case for Harris if you think that she will deliver that. Whatever. I don't want to like rule it out. But like Harris had kind of like gone out of the top tier and therefore didn't get that kind of elevated scrutiny that people do get there. But like, you know, she's been in California politics. Her big Joe Biden takedown was like – it was about race, right? Mm-hmm. And she is not – right? Like Obama was the black politician who spent all this time telling white people about how he wasn't like one of those black politicians, right? And like Harris is not – done that. I got to see. You know what I mean?
I think an interesting thing about Harris that we'll see how she plays it. One thing we were talking about with Biden earlier was that he, as of yet, is not – he's not kind of holding the line on some of the things that you might expect him to hold the line on. Something that's been striking to me about her is that she actually is.
Yes.
She's gotten a lot of scrutiny about her prosecutorial record.
Yes.
Where she is a Democrat who is still from a period of time. She frames herself as a progressive prosecutor, which in many ways she was. But also prosecutors are tougher on crime.
And she does hold to the view that crime is bad.
Yeah,
and it's in fact good to arrest criminals, which I always appreciate.
And so I – we'll see. My point is not that like Harris will definitely win in 2020.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
My point is more that coming out of this, I think it reshuffled the sense of like what is that top – like Biden looks a lot weaker. And Harris, who I would say was in – I think that it's Nate Silver who's had these sort of weird tiers. It's like
– she was like, in like tier 2BF,
yeah, something
I
like
think.
That.
Like, it's very...
But I think it like – it's a jump up, right?
Yeah.
She's now like I would say maybe 2A or 1B or
something. I also want to say something pro-Harris, which is that I have found – because I've often been annoyed about the other candidates on this score – that like Harris seems to give the most thought to the – literal question of what she would do as president.
Yes.
Like she has this like maybe illegal gun control idea. Her signature legislation is like well crafted to qualify for budget reconciliation treatment.
It's a big
treatment.
Earned income tax credit.
Right. Rather than like asserting that she's going to end filibusters or something, she's like thinking about the actual problems, which I do find good.
Also, I want to know one other thing on her because we were talking about the Medicare stuff earlier. And Harris, the thing that happened initially when she came into the campaign in the CNN town halls. And by the way, the debates kind of make me nostalgic for the CNN town halls with their depth, is that, you know, she got kind of tied up in this abolished private insurance thing. And then she kind of walked that back over time. Then it looked like last night she had like gone like way back into it. And then she got another question where the question about this was quite unusually phrased.
Yep.
And so she says that like the way she interpreted it was, would you give up your own insurance for this? She actually may still be holding to the – try to like fuzz the sides of this a little bit, which I actually don't think would be an unwise strategy.
Yeah. So I want to talk about Bernie Sanders. I feel like I am one of the only people in America who is warmer to the Bernie 2020 campaign than I was to the Bernie 2016 campaign.
Oh, I definitely feel that way.
Okay. It frustrates me that I don't feel like he's like trying to win the election. I don't understand what's like going on out there, because a lot of these other candidates, right? You know, you're talking about like Pete Buttigieg. He's a huge star. That means he's polling at 8%, right? So like a good performance for Mayor Pete is like get to 11%, right? You have other people out there, like nobody knows who the fuck Jay Inslee is, right? So he's just like trying to get attention, right? But everybody knows who Bernie Sanders is, right? He's been out there for a long time. He ran a strong campaign in 2016. He got a lot of people to vote for him, but it was not enough people to win the election. So now what he has to do is like not literally repeat himself time and again, but like address arguments that are relevant to voters in 2020 who are not currently supporting him. And like I would love to hear him say explicitly, for example, that like one good thing about Bernie Sanders is that, yes, it is true that some of his economic policy ideas the media finds kooky. But one nice thing about that is it means that with Bernie Sanders, you get a debate about the concrete material interests of the American people rather than about like Donald Trump's like racist circus.
He kind of said that, I would say.
He
gave an answer on the debate field where he just said, yeah, the way we win against Donald Trump is we expose him for a fraud on economics in a way that has not been done yet. I think the difficulty Bernie Sanders had up there last night, and I'll say like you, I'm much warmer to him, but on concrete things. One, I think in 2016, Bernie Sanders is actually a politician I've always liked. I've covered him for a long time. Like I think you, like I have a reputation of being hard on him, and I try to be tough on candidates' plans when they're a little wan. But I've always liked him as a politician because he's always said a lot of interesting things. Mm-hmm. And as a presidential candidate, then you have this sort of like different level of scrutiny. Like how do you run your policy process? Sure. What kind of staff do you attract? Since 2016, he's pulled in a lot of really strong staff. Mm-hmm. He's really stepped up his game on foreign policy in a way that I actually think separates him from the rest of the field in an important way.
Yes.
And he's like tightened a lot of the policies that he was running on. So I think there's a lot to be said there. The thing about the two nights of debates, it was really striking. Bernie Sanders' ideas won those debates. I mean, they set the terms of the whole conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, that was true on free college. It was true on Medicare for All. The way Bernie Sanders distinguishes himself and distinguished himself in 2016 was that he's the only guy who supports these like kooky left-wing ideas. But now that they're not kooky left-wing ideas, now that every candidate has either adopted them or has adopted some kind of like weaponized counterattack, it's much harder for him to distinguish himself. So he's actually left like trying to stand out on style and approach and like calls for political revolution. And he just had a lot more trouble having already set the terms of the debate. He had like for his ideas, he had trouble resetting it for him. It's like oftentimes it seemed like Kamala Harris was winning a debate over Bernie Sanders' ideas with Bernie Sanders like standing over there on the stage. Or the same thing was true in different with Elizabeth Warren.
The foreign policy piece though is important because like unlike all this other stuff they talk about, like this is what the president actually
does. But he nailed Joe Biden on that, I thought.
Yeah, no.
Like that was his best moment of the debate by far.
Yes. No. I agree with that. And it's weird that this like Biden takedown happened over this like somewhat obscure 1970s busing incident, because like the foreign policy to me seems like Joe Biden's like on the merits. Like this is what gives me pause about Joe Biden, which is that like I covered not like prehistoric Joe Biden, but like modern day Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, Chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee Joe Biden. And, you know, like he's a nice guy. He's smart. He knows a lot of world leaders. But when questions would arise that prominent Democrats disagreed about, right, like more often than not, Joe Biden was on the wrong side of that disagreement. Like Nancy Pelosi chaired the Intelligence Committee. And Joe Biden chaired the Foreign Relations Committee. Nancy Pelosi, as a chair of a relevant committee, decided that George W. Bush was on the wrong track. Joe Biden decided he was on the right track, right? Biden came out with this plan at some point that like the only possible solution was to partition Iraq, right? And like that wasn't right. Biden was right, I think, inside the Obama administration's debate about the Afghanistan surge.
It's not
like a cartoon who's like blundering at every step of the way. So like he was right on that one. But I think he was for the Libya intervention, which I don't agree with.
He was against, if I remember, the
Bin Laden raid.
Bin Laden raid.
Right. So like I don't know.
He was
man.
Also inside internal Obama administration. This is off foreign policy, but he was against doing Obamacare,
right.
at least at that scale.
So, like, I have no idea whether Cory Booker would make good foreign policy decisions under pressure. I've never heard him address the topic. But, like, Biden has, like, an extensive track record of this, and, like, it's worse than coin flipping.
But,
and I don't, that's
but
not
the
great.
Other piece, his answer on this. So he got this question from Rachel mm-hmm. Maddow, basically, having been on the wrong side of, right. of Iraq, why should we trust your foreign policy views? His answer to me was his by far worst moment of the debate. I don't know that it will be his most damaging, but it was the one that revealed the most weakness.
Right, it didn't
so,
make any sense.
So first, it didn't make any sense. He had to know this was coming. Like,
right.
this is the obvious question to ask Joe Biden. It's also come up before, right? Like, it came up in 2008. It's come up since then. What he said was he kind of, like, hitched a little bit at the beginning. It was hard to, like, follow. But what he then said was, after George W. Bush, like, abused the power I gave him or helped to give him, I was elected with Obama. And Obama turned to me and he said, Joe, you need to pull the troops out of Iraq. And then I pulled them, including my son, 150,000 troops out of Iraq. And so a few things on this. One, this thing that Biden is doing, which I do get the politics of, where it's like the way the Obama administration worked was Obama had a thing you want to do. He's like, Joe, you do it. And then every time Joe just, like, personally, like, drove everybody. That's not true. Like, that's not how any of this worked. But the second thing is, the theory of the Joe Biden candidacy is that he is a successor to Obama's presidency. And to be that successor, the thing that you want to do is be the person on the stage who reflects Obama's thinking best, right? Like, you had Obama as president. You would like to have him as president again. Like, Joe Biden is your next best thing.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Biden's not doing that. He didn't give an answer that said, you know, I think Barack Obama was right about this and I was wrong. And what I learned from that is that, you know, blah, 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 whatever it might have been is a theory of foreign policy and a theory of measuring intervention in other countries. He's not running as Obama too. He's running with Obama as a shield.
Right.
He's not the guy on the stage who sounds like Barack Obama. That's probably Pete Buttigieg or something. It's maybe in some ways Kamala Harris. Like, he's running as the guy who, like, hides behind Barack Obama. And that's subtly different. Like, for a little you hear it the first four times, you're like, yeah, that's smart. Like, Joe Biden is, like, defending Obama or, like, mentioning that he worked with Obama. And then you realize that at no point is he actually really echoing Obama. He's just sort of using it as a protective device. And I don't think that's going to wear well. Like, he actually either needs a good argument of his own or he needs Obama's good arguments. But this thing where he's like, my bad arguments don't matter because I served behind somebody. Like, that's a really good case for electing Barack Obama, but it's not a very good case for electing Joe Biden.
Well, and I do think I will be interested to see whether anybody ever puts this point more squarely. Because, like, I've talked to a number of older working class people, Democrats like Joe Biden, and they always cite this, like, Obama thing. And I feel like it reflects on their part a not super attentive person's understanding of what the role of vice president is. Right. And so, like, Biden was a ticket balancing pick.
Yes.
Right. Now, like, Obama,
he's a foil.
Oh, Obama likes Joe Biden. Obama's team respects Joe Biden. They think he made valuable contributions to their team, but it was a complementary pieces selection, like, deliberately, right? It was an effort to show that, like, Barack Obama is not alarmingly woke, that, like, he will hang out with this, like, gaffe-prone older white guy from Pennsylvania, right? Like, it wasn't like, here's my double.
Right.
Right.
It,
like,
wasn't a Clinton Al Gore pick.
Right. It wasn't, if you love Barack Obama, you will also love Joe Biden. It was actually, if you have serious doubts about Barack Obama, you will find Joe Biden reassuring.
Yes.
And it worked. Like, it was a good pick. Like, it made the Obama ticket stronger, and it arguably made the Obama administration stronger. But what is not true is that if you are a Barack Obama superfan, you should draw from that the conclusion that, like, Joe Biden is the next best thing. It's like – it's literally the opposite of that,
yes.
Right? It's that, like, you wouldn't run an Obama-Booker ticket because that would be pointless.
And this is why in 2016 the Obama world did not cohere around Biden. I mean, I did reporting on this, and it was always frustrating I didn't get to use a piece because Biden, like, firmly dropped out before
right.
I could publish. But I had talked to a bunch of people in Obama world to ask, why isn't – there any support mm-hmm. behind mm-hmm. Joe Biden? Like, why don't I – like, Hillary Clinton is not that strong. Like, why don't I hear anybody sort of pushing him in or just anything? Like, he's a well-liked vice president. Like, what happened there? And what I heard kind of again and again was, we love Joe Biden. Like, Joe's great. But the thing is, you don't really want him running the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
You want him in the meetings.
Yeah.
But if you like Obama's cool, technocratic, managerially disciplined style, super empirical, that's just not how Biden operates. And so people who were attracted to Obama were not then naturally attracted to the idea of Joe Biden being president. They really like Joe Biden. But to your point, he's a foil. And he's not just a foil in his public image. He's a foil in how he operates. He's a foil in how he makes decisions. He's a foil in how he runs a meeting. Obama's like disciplined and things end on time, like Joe Biden's endless bull sessions. Like it went pretty deep. And so now I think there's a little bit more, both for some views about electability and some views, you know, something about the kind of Sanders and some even Warren like fights with the Obama world, is that a lot of people who are around Obama and like have now paid their dues in the Democratic Party and want like that next position in the White House, if Sanders and to a lesser but still very real potential extent Warren get the nod, they don't get it. And so I think there actually is a little bit more circling around Joe Biden because like that's more restoration, although again somebody like Kamala Harris could interrupt that. But there isn't a circling around him in the sense of, look, I served with Barack Obama. Like this is the next best thing. Like that's not the argument.
Right.
Can we talk about Elizabeth Warren?
Well, let's take another break.
Okay.
And then do it.
Support for this show comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise, an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab, tracks the stories making news right now and breaks them down for the average investor. Host Mike Townsend, Charles Schwab's Managing Director for Legislative and Regulatory Affairs, takes a nonpartisan look at the stories that matter most to investors. He explores topics like policy initiatives for retirement savings, taxes, and trade, inflation fears, the Federal Reserve, and how regulatory developments can affect companies, sectors, and even the entire market. In every episode, Mike and his guests offer their perspectives on how policy changes could affect what you do with your portfolio. Download the latest episode and follow at schwab.com/WashingtonWise or wherever you listen.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Kara Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds 4 times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
So night one, it had a lot less electricity because it didn't have all of these like, you know, top tier players. But Warren was really the candidate everything revolved around.
Yep.
I'm curious what your impressions were.
You know, I thought that like Warren has been on the rise, and then I thought Warren delivered like a very poised, very competent, like skillful performance. I know some people are wigged out by her endorsing of the healthcare thing, but I thought that like tactically, it's 100% correct for her to not get into a fight with Bernie Sanders' people about this. She is clearly she is not actually appealing to Bernie Sanders' voters, but I think she is trying to appeal to Bernie Sanders. She is looking forward to a potential future scenario in which she gets ahead of him in the polls and he drops out and endorses her, which from a like issues standpoint would advance his kind of policy topics. And, you know, she just showed that, like, she is skillful up there. There's an Elizabeth Warren duality, right? And there's one Elizabeth Warren who was up there on the stage and who generated a lot of internet memes from the most diehard Hillary Clinton-loving people who I know, right? Which is just appealing to an axis of accomplished professional woman competency-ness. There's like an identity politics around that, mm-hmm. that like both Hillary and Warren are like really good at their jobs, right? And that I think clearly has an appeal to like a certain kind of person, right, who looks up to that and wants to see the kind of diligence that they both exhibit rewarded.
In a generalized sense, I also like seeing people who are good at their jobs and somewhat crave that in politics right now.
Not me. I like the you know, the sloppy messes, but I can't emphasize enough that, like, while they're kind of similar people and they inspire similar devotion in their staffs and things like that, like, Hillary Clinton and Elizabeth Warren have very different, like, ideas about public policy. And I do think people should take that somewhat seriously, particularly because Warren's operation is so policy oriented. Like, she really is very diligent. She really is very competent. And she has, like, a, you know, like a kind of vast team of, like, grim ideologues drawn from America's law school faculties who she wants to install in positions of power. And, like, it doesn't reflect poorly on her, but, like, it should be taken.
Wait, say what are you saying here exactly? Like, what's your takeaway on this? I mean, obviously she is more liberal than Hillary Clinton. I have views on how they differ, but I feel like you're saying something that I'm not quite hearing.
I think a lot of people who just, like, really like hate Bernie Sanders have, like, hopped on the Warren bandwagon to, like, excise their, like, emotional angst about the 2016 primary. And, like, they should think about, like, do they actually agree with Elizabeth Warren? Like, I think a really good reason to vote for Elizabeth Warren is, like, you want her policy agenda. It's become like a meme. Like, Warren has so many plans, but, like, have you read those plans?
I don't think I agree with this on a couple levels. So let me say it two ways. One, I do think that to take your side to this for a minute, the plans thing feels like a quite false analogy to me between Warren and Clinton, not just because the plans differ, but because Hillary
Warren's
Clinton,
plans reflect a totalizing worldview.
Yes.
Hillary's is like, I talked to some guy yesterday.
Hillary Clinton had a plan for everything. And that meant she had literally as many messages as she had plans. Like, she would come into every single issue, like, look at it, like, come up with some plan that could plausibly pass into the system that you could imagine. Mm-hmm. And, like, there you go, right? This is what the experts told her to do. And so, like, nothing ever cohered into a singular message. Elizabeth Warren is a very talented technocratic, like, thinker, but she's an anti-system thinker, not a pro-system thinker. Yep. And she's more than she's a talented policymaker. She's an incredibly, like, best of class, generationally capable, talented policy communicator.
Yep.
And, like, that's how she came out of nowhere to create the CFPB and then win a Senate seat in Massachusetts and now be one of the leading candidates for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And behind that, Elizabeth Warren has a lot of plans and they all basically say the same thing. They all say wealthy people have too much money and opportunity and power, and she is going to redistribute those concentrations of economic power and opportunity and spread them around more widely.
Yep.
And, like, whether you are, like, that is why her wealth tax and all the things it will buy is at the very center of her identity. I really would encourage people to listen to her interview on my show on that, or you can find it in the Weeds feed too. She talks a lot about that there, and I think you can see exactly how she frames that. But over and over again, like, what she's able to do is she has a lot of plans that reinforce one message, not a lot of plans to create a lot of different messages.
Yep.
And so in that way, I think the feeling – what I see is a lot of people fearfully comparing Warren and Clinton. Like, Clinton had plans too. Clinton was the best prepared too.
Yep.
But putting aside the fact that, like, Clinton basically performed as a banal Democrat and won, you know, 3 million more votes and all of that, Warren is offering a message through her plans about what she would do to change the system. And Hillary Clinton just had a lot of plans that reflected her, like, status as a policymaker within the system.
Yep.
It's pretty different.
Yes. No, I think we are 100% in agreement. Your version of this is, like, if you are terrified that Elizabeth Warren is Hillary Clinton 2.0, like, relax. She's actually quite different.
Yes.
My version of this is, like, if you are thrilled that Elizabeth Warren is Hillary Clinton 2.0, like, pay closer attention because they're actually quite different.
But do you think there are that many people who – see, I think my interpretation of the Hillary Clinton thing here is that a lot of people liked Clinton's preparation and competence and so on and actually didn't really like the ways in which she was bounded by her life within the system. And so the people who like the symmetry between them, Warren is fixing a problem they had with Clinton more often than she is creating a problem they didn't. Like, I hear what you're saying, that, like, Warren is a strong shift to the left from Hillary Clinton, at least in a number of areas, although I think probably not every area. But I don't know that those are the parts of Hillary Clinton that people wanted to preserve.
One thing Warren says in all her speeches and stuff is that, like, we need big structural change in America, right? And I don't know, talking to people who are mad about Donald Trump, it's like, do they think we need big structural change in America? Or do they think we need Donald Trump to not be the president? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because, like, Warren really, like, she sincerely believes that we need big structural change in America. And now, obviously, nobody is going to stand up there and be like, eh, not that much is going to change, but Donald Trump won't be president. But I think if you look at Pete Buttigieg, right, who, because, again, they have demographically similar supporters, but I think actually different things going on, right? That, like, what Mayor Pete is saying is that, like, I'm like you, Weeds listener. Like, I am an intelligent, thoughtful person who tries to pay attention to what's going on and just say things that make sense, right? And that is a big personality contrast with Donald Trump. And then if you listen to Pete on, like, a variety of topics, like, he has thoughtful answers to these questions. He does not have, like, a vast totalizing worldview or, like, an agenda for sweeping systematic change. He's, like, the kind of guy who might be a good mayor of your city, right? Which is, like, a job where, as mayor, it's like you take over, right? And then just, like, stuff happens and you try to deal with it competently, right? Whereas Donald Trump is president, like, he takes over and, like, nothing's happening. And then he's just, like, throwing things all over the room, right? And, like, it's crazy and it's chaos. And I think there's, like, like, Warren's structural change message, like, that makes sense. I can see why you might want that. But I think you also might just want, like, competent managerialism. And just to say, like, no change in any area of public policy, like, the minimum wage has not been raised for 15 years. Like, that should be raised, right? But, like, is the big problem with America that, like, we need to, like, take these PDFs Warren has put out about, like, all the corporate executives who deserve to be in prison? Or is the problem that Donald Trump is president? Because there's, like, a big difference between, like, imprisoning a vast swath of corporate executives and just kicking Donald Trump out of the White House. And I just feel like the, like, Warren discourse, it's, like, very, like, hooray, she has a plan for that. But it's like, what is the plan? Like, do you agree with that plan? Like, is this really
a
good idea?
That is fair. And listeners should read her plans and look into their hearts. I do want to note one thing about her plans, because I think something that is interesting about Warren is where she doesn't have a plan.
Healthcare?
And, well, two things, right? So immigration and healthcare.
Yeah.
It is in the places where she does not have a specific plan that she has adopted her, like, most unpopularly left-wing views, I would say. At least of the things I know. Basically, Elizabeth Warren is extremely good at releasing plans that if you poll them, they should poll well. Free college doesn't poll as well as I would have thought. So that's not 100% true, but I think that's been certainly to me a bit of a surprise. The reason I bring this up is that it's clearly not the case that Elizabeth Warren doesn't have the staffing, the personal inclination,
yes,
or the personal capacity to create a healthcare plan of her own,
yes,
or an immigration plan of her own. And so it seems to me like my kind of galaxy brain on this, if that's the right level of brain, maybe it's not, is that what she is doing is it in endorsing other people's ideas here, she's not leaving any room for them to get around her. Because, like, Bernie Sanders can't say, like, the big difference between me and Elizabeth Warren is healthcare. Because, like, Elizabeth –
yes, I think if she wins,
if
then
she wins, then she's going to have the Elizabeth Warren healthcare plan or the Elizabeth Warren immigration plan, where maybe it doesn't have Section 1325, but it replaces Section 1325 with another section that does something else so that it's not literally decriminalizing border crossing, but it is changing how it is. I don't know. But I just think that is an interesting, like, question mark here.
Yes.
Because she releases so many plans, not releasing a plan is a very distinct choice.
Yes.
And why she is making that choice is worthy of some interrogation.
Yes. No, I agree with that, especially because, right, I mean, if you think about these two topic areas, I mean, you signal them out as, like, areas where she did politically dicey hand-raising. But it's like healthcare is the top issue priority,
yes,
for Democrats. Right? And immigration is, like, the emotional centerpiece of Trump-era politics.
Yes.
So those are, like, some odd lacunae, right, to just kind of, like, miss out on. And if you look at some of the other candidates, right, like, those –
a detailed breakup Amazon plan. But healthcare, you know.
Right.
Bernie Sanders has some good ideas.
So if you look at, like, Castro and O'Rourke, right, who both have, like, released a few plans but not that comprehensively, like, they both have immigration plans because,
yes,
they, like – see that as an important area to, like, put out a flag on, right? Where it's like, obviously, it has not escaped Elizabeth Warren's attention that people are arguing a lot about immigration policy, right? She is waiting to come up with something. And I hope, you know, she comes up with something good on it. I want to say about immigration, beyond the, like, four corners of this 1325 thing, I found the way all of the Democrats talked about immigration up there to be a little bit problematic. The people who vote in elections are American citizens. And so when you talk about your education plan, you're talking about how the plan will help Americans, right? When you talk about your healthcare plan, you talk about how it will help Americans. When you talk about your immigration plan, like I am very pro-immigrant. Like I think America should have like a generous, kind, humane, welcoming immigration policy. But like I think that because I think that's like good for Americans, it's like not just a question of abstract benevolence. And like there's a reason why we don't have long debate exchanges about people's foreign aid programs. Even though like objectively it's important what you do there, it's not important to Americans' lives. And like you have to get there on immigration. Like this is not an area of political strength for Democrats. You know what I mean? Like it's true that like Trump's most extreme immigration antics are not popular. But like you don't want to go to the American people with like Donald Trump wants to put America first and Democrats want to put Honduran asylum seekers first. Like you need to think about what you're trying to do and why it's good and like explain that. The 1325 was like a signpost of that, right? That like when people were embracing this, they didn't say, I want to decriminalize border crossing because – and then like give me some reason why it would make my life better, right? Maybe it's a huge drag on the judicial system's resources. But come up with something.
So this is the – this is like my totalizing worldview of how politics works. But you were saying earlier that this debate is full of a lot of policy position taking. Mm-hmm. And yet people don't care that much about policy, at least not a lot of the distinctions between it. What they do care a lot about is identity. And a lot of the policies that people are taking in this debate are about establishing an identity of some kind or another. And in the Democratic Party right now, being pro-immigrant mm-hmm. is a very important part of the Democratic identity. And Donald Trump has made it a much more central part of the Democratic identity. And so showing that you will take risk and fire on this is a way of establishing like the strength of that identity. Similarly with the Medicare for All stuff, one thing you don't really hear that much in the whole Medicare for All debate is a debate over – well, why? Like what? Like you could just lower payment rates for everybody to mm-hmm. Medicare levels. Private insurers, like if you talk to healthcare wonks, are just like not the biggest deal in the system one way mm-hmm. or the other. Like payment rates are much more important and you have national health systems that do have private insurers and national health systems that don't and you can do it all kinds of different ways. But it's an identity thing, right? Like I'm somebody who believes. I'm somebody who is against. And it's like who are your enemies? What is your group? And so a lot of the things happening in the debate, it seems to me, and this is particularly true on immigration, which is a very deep question of national identity and like what does it mean to be an American? What does it mean to be a liberal? To your point, they're having a debate that seems curiously disconnected from Americans' material interests. But this is constantly like the left-wing refrain, like why are these debates so disconnected from people's material interests? And it's because people primarily – like they very heavily participate in politics in terms of identity and group status. And these debates are keying in on those motivations more than they are like a serious discussion of like who has the best policy and taking an empirical look at this and given the implementation difficulties, like what will this do for the country? And like I put a little bit of that on the moderators and the way debates are structured. They're not built to like have that conversation. But nevertheless, there's a kind of position taking here that is very much about Democratic and liberal identities. And just right now, and I think this is also a nature of an unsettled field and a very big field, there is very little thought about the general election. Right. And I think people are just planning to like
right.
You know, we'll
but, it, but I mean it's precisely because people vote more on identity than on policy that like this way of talking about immigration worries me.
Yeah.
Because like
I agree
with that. I think there's like a lot of different approaches to immigration that like can fly with the American public, but that to the typical person, what is non-negotiable is that like your concern
yes.
as a government has to be with Americans,
yes.
right? And there's like – that could be a million things. And like who's ever heard of Section 1320? You know like you could do different things. And but yes, I like they are very keyed in on this. What's interesting to me is that we did not see much talk about trade, right? Because trade is actually an issue in which like Democrats in good standing have like serious like directional disagreements, right? Like they can nitpick each other's healthcare plans like until, you know, the cows come home, but they're all sort of saying the same thing about healthcare, which is like the government should be more involved and do more to regulate prices and do more to subsidize people's care. Like there are Democrats who believe that free trade is really good, that abandoning the Trans-Pacific Partnership was a mistake, that we should go forward with a TTIP with Europe. And there are Democrats who believe that like NAFTA was a huge error, that letting China into the WTO was a huge error, and that Donald Trump has been like a trade policy faker. And, you know, so I have heard the speeches from Warren and Sanders on one side of that debate. I've heard more pro-trade sentiments from O'Rourke and from Joe Biden. But it was not like brought in to the debate at all, even though this is a subject where there's like not like a – not like a I'm trying to annoy you by making you pick fights with each other, but where they have like really – like sincere directional disagreement about the trajectory of national policy and where it touches on some of these same identity type issues, right? Like one of the theories of Sanders and Warren and like going back before them, like of Dick Gephardt, right? Like one idea Democrats have had is that they should use protectionist trade policy to key in on nationalistic sentiments that Republicans that like George W. Bush used to promote like hawkish foreign policy, right? And then another idea is that like, no, like Democrats should promote like cosmopolitanism as an economic development strategy for the United States, right? And so it's like it's going to appeal to different kinds of people and it has pretty substantial implications, right? Like this is like one of the big ways Trump has turned politics a little bit sideways. And it was strange to me to not really discuss it at all.
Thankfully, we have 1,000 more debates.
The dream. The dream. All right. Well, thanks to everybody out there for listening. Thanks to Ezra. Thanks to Jackson Bierfeld and our producer, Jeffrey Geld. And The Weeds will be back on Tuesday.
Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.